When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Good Humans Podcast with me, Cooper Chapman, chatting to the world's best about the inspiring stories that got them to where they are today. What's going on, you good humans? Welcome to episode 151 of Good Humans Podcast with the very, very special Emma Murray. Emma is a mindfulness coach. She works in the space working with high achievers in high performance mindfulness. So corporate CEOs, high level athletes from the F1 Oscar Piastri to supercar drivers. And the one that she's probably best known for is working with the Richmond Football Club, Dusty Martin and a few of the other top players as they won the premiership back in 2018, 2020 and 2021. So this is an epic chat and you guys are going to really love it. Of course, a big thank you to our couple of sponsors. So Wild Earth Australia have been supporting me getting ready for my UTA Ultra Trail Australia 100 kilometer race coming up in just under a month now, May 18th, I'm going to be running 100 kilometers and I've been getting all of my gear, all of my equipment from Wild Earth Australia. So if you want to check out what Wild Earth do, head over to their website, wildearth.com.au, and you can learn all about all of the equipment that they have for hiking, trail running, running, fishing, all of the good stuff. You can pick it up at Wild Earth. And they've done a very special thing for all of our followers of this podcast. If you click the link in the show notes, you can sign up to the Wild Earth Wallet Pass and get a discount price all day, every day. Anything you want online, or if you go in store, you can add the little wallet pass to your phone and get a discount anytime you go in. They've got a store at Burleigh Heads and also in Brisbane. Yeah, these guys are legends. They've been helping me out a lot. So if you want to get some gear for your running, get some gear for any of your adventures, make sure you head into Wild Earth Australia. Also, Drink a Rapper, the brain drink. These guys have been supporting this podcast for a very long time, and it's a product that I use every single day. So if you're someone who has a brain, which I guess is every single person who's listening to this podcast, then I encourage you to go check out Drink a Rapper. You can learn all about their science. It's a black currant drink, basically. Think an energy drink, but without anything bad in it. All natural ingredients, no caffeine, and just all stuff that's going to make your brain perform better in the short term for performance, but also has some really good benefits for your long-term neurological health as well. So head over to their website, drinkarepa.com. Use code GOODHUMAN over on their website. You can get a big 25% off everything. And also, if you go to Coles or Woolies, look for the purple glass bottle with a big A on it. It says Arepa. And give it a try. Let me know what you think. Would love to know. Okay, today's actually very special. You are in the 1 week where the Good Human Factory has a whole new range of winter merch. And I've done it a little bit differently this winter because I always overstock and buy too much stock thinking there's going to be more people buying the Good Human Factory merch than do every time. So I end up having a discount sale stuff right at the end of season. And I don't want to do that this year. I want to be better for the environment, not have just a bunch of dead stock and make you guys be able to have a little purchase week. I'll get it ordered and it'll be sent out about a week and a half later. So if you head over to thegoodhumanfactory.com, have a look through all of the new merch. It's been a lot of effort gone into this. Our best sellers, the Be Kind to Your Mind and also the Receipt Tee, are going to be fully restocked for pre-sale, and we have two new hoodies in both of those designs in black and butter. So head over, check that out. It really means a lot to me supporting the Good Human Factory. It allows me to continue doing this work, putting out this free content on the podcast, and going and doing my keynotes at high schools, at corporate groups, and with sporting clubs. So if you want to learn more about that, head over to thegoodhumanfactory.com, check out the merch page. You can also learn about the workshops over there and learn about all the things that we do with the Good Human Factory. All right, Emma Murray, Far out. I've had a really special week with Emma. So Emma's someone who I've really looked up to her work. Obviously, mindfulness is something that's really important to me, and the work that I pursue and the content that I create is really heavily into mindset and into mindfulness and being present. And Emma's someone who I've always looked up to, watching her work through the AFL, but also with Oscar Piastri, the F1. But where I really heard a lot of her work was through Dylan Buckley's podcast, Dylan Friends, who's been a previous guest on this podcast, and he's one of the most incredible podcasters in Australia, and he has Emma on every year. And I just love the way that she shares her story and the skills, and the way that she just understands high performance mindfulness is second to none. So I'd been sending her DMs every now and then and asking her to come on the podcast, and she was like, yep, I'll come on. I love the work that you do. And then she actually offered me and said, would you like to come to this retreat that I'm hosting in Byron Bay at this retreat center called Soma, and bring your partner as well, and we can do the podcast there. So I was like, absolutely. So I just spent 3 days with Emma, really diving deep into her teachings and learning with her and being part of the community of people at her retreat, which was the most beautiful experience ever. I had such an amazing time, and you're going to hear a bit about it throughout this episode. So Emma has a great story. I really think this episode went a bit of a different direction than I was expecting. I thought it was going to be really about the high performance mindfulness, which it definitely is, but we really went deep into her story. I took her back and we went on a bit of a journey throughout her story. And I think it's a really good episode for women who have children and just for anyone who's maybe in a job where they're not really fulfilled and they want more. She talks about her continually striving for new education, finding new courses around mindfulness, hypnosis, and all these different incredible skills that she gathered. And then it was just a big timing thing. A few opportunities came to her. She was at the right place at the right time. And then her work really helped teams like Richmond win premierships. And then people started to really see the value in the work that she delivers. So I love this episode. I know you guys will too. If you do enjoy it, send it to a friend. Put it in your family group chat. Send it in your friend group chat. Put it on your Instagram story. This episode really has the potential to make a big impact. And you guys who are listening to this right now have the potential to make it go further. So hit that like button, subscribe button, 5 stars, all those things that help the podcast grow. I really appreciate it. But let's do it. Let's jump into the podcast. Welcome to Good Humans Podcast, Emma Murray. How are you going, Emma?
I'm good. Oh, I'm good. I've been in Soma retreat for 3 days, so
yeah, very good. You're my first guest that I salsa danced with within an hour of recording a podcast.
I know, we were good.
We were.
Yeah, yeah. We were good. Yeah.
Yes. So to set the scene for everyone, myself and Emma are at Soma Retreat Space in Byron Bay for Emma's incredible high performance mindfulness retreat with 14 guests here.
About that, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. Myself and my partner Carol are here immersing ourselves in your incredible learnings. And you're someone who I've been inspired by for a long time, as you probably are aware of that. The work that I do is in a very similar space, but trying to share my version of it and trying to understand more. So when the opportunity came to come here, I was like, wow, this is going to be amazing. So first of all, thank you so much for having us.
We've loved having you both. And I think the retreat has been made richer because you bring, well, every guest at the retreat brings a perspective, but because you've lived your story and have your skills in mental health and daily habits and rituals, it's, you know, been great for the retreat.
No, well, thank you. Like I said, I'm beyond grateful for the opportunity to be here. But today's going to be a really cool chat. You've been at the very top of my list for someone I've wanted to speak to on the podcast for a long time. Dylan Buckley, who's, I know, a great friend of yours. And you have an episode with him at the start of every year, which I very much look forward to. And I've always been like, I really want to get Emma on the podcast. And then I noticed you'd followed me on Instagram. And I was like, she doesn't follow that many people. Maybe I'll send her a DM. And you were like, you got me at the perfect time. I'm at an airport in Singapore and I never check my DMs.
No.
And it was just the right timing and here we are.
Yeah, yeah. No, we were stuck there for like 18 hours. And I had set myself the task on, I'd been away for like 3.5 weeks and I thought, I'm not coming back unless I've checked my DMs. It's a real point of anxiety for me. And I opened it up and there was your message. So, yes,
life's perfect timing. All about timing, isn't it, sometimes? One of the first things I always open with on the podcast is the same for every guest, and I'd love to hear your answer for this. So what are you grateful for right now in your life?
Gratitude. I mean, we've spoken a lot about gratitude on the retreat, and I openly admit that I've had an interesting journey with gratitude, and I don't have a daily gratitude practice. I sit a lot more with where my life is at. I daily have a lot of acceptance, but I try to sit in this energy of gratitude as opposed to a list of things that I'm grateful for. So I could list a million different things, you know, my family, this retreat, my clients, you know, my health, all of that stuff. But for me, I'm trying to sit in a feeling that I'm just like, this is pretty cool what I get to do each day, just be here and have great kids. And yeah, so more sitting for me in just a feeling of gratitude rather than a feeling of lack. Like, I don't have this and I don't have that, and this is not working and that's not working.
Yeah, I love that. It's a good way to look at it. And I feel like sometimes the practice of gratitude can become a little bit looked at from the outside as like this catchy, gimmicky thing. So I think people listening right now who have listened to a lot of my episodes and heard people list off gratitudes can get a lot out of that. And I know I've got a lot out of this retreat, the way you speak about gratitude too, and trying to always evolve the way that we look at gratitude and realize, like we were talking a bit earlier this morning at the retreat about Joe Dispenza and the way he talks about energy fields and it not just being something you list off, but like you said, something that you just live in, you feel.
Yeah. You know, if you look at Joe's work, you know, it's very science-based, it's very evidence-based, and there's a hell of a lot to it. So I would not be doing it justice by saying just gratitude's a big part of it. But he is asking you to sit effectively in a feeling of gratitude, excitement, and just peace around the unknown. And that's why I don't necessarily have three things I'm grateful for, because the learnings I've done through people like Joe is like sitting in just this gratitude for what's to come. You don't know what it is, what it's going to look like, how it's going to show up, but you know it's absolutely what you wanted and what you created. So he talks about, you know, the unknown all of the time. And I think that if we get into this feeling that we're grateful for what's coming, even though we don't have a plan and we know it and it's scheduled and we know how it's going to work out, then we are more open in our days and we see more opportunity and things seemingly fall in our lap. But because we are moving forward with this you know, appreciation for something's coming, not sure what it is, and we've got no expectation around what that looks like, then we just have different conversations with people and we look at things differently. And that's when maybe people call it manifestation. Oh, I manifested that. I just look at it, well, I was sitting in an open mindset that enabled me to, you know, that opportunity to come to me.
I love that. Do you think, from a point of view, to get to that state, practicing gratitude is a good way to begin to sort of move towards that? Because the way that I talk about gratitude and the way that I encourage people in my community is to practice gratitude daily. But what I've started to see is people go, oh, by practicing it daily, it's like more good things are happening. But it's like, no, you're just noticing more. And I feel like that's kind of the starting point, is sometimes to start going, okay, I'm grateful for this, this, and then you start going, oh, there is a lot of things, and the more I practice it, the more things that seem to be around me that I can be in that field of gratitude around.
Yeah, and how I would explain that is when we are in an emotional state of gratitude. So when I use that word emotional state, it's like a sum total of everything that's going on for us. It's our thoughts, it's our feelings, it's our posture, it's our voice, it's all of these things. And we know that because if we saw someone come in a room and their eyes are down and their shoulders are slumped and they're dragging their feet, we would think that they were feeling down or they're flat or they're unmotivated, or in worst case, they're feeling depressed. And so we know that the emotional state, you know, has this entire energy and body to it. And when we get into the emotional state of gratitude, we walk into a moment thinking this is great and I'm you know, excited to be here and I'm anticipating something good happening. I have this open posture. I have, you know, curiosity, and I have a completely different emotional state when I walk into that moment. And then I walk into that moment, and because my posture is open and I'm smiling and I'm curious and I'm asking questions, I have a conversation with someone that I wouldn't have had if I was walking into that moment going, I don't want to be here. Mm. What will people think of me? I'm not as, you know, I don't know anyone, or I'm not as smart as the other people in the room. Then we're closed. We're not curious. Our eyes are down. You know, we're isolating ourselves and we don't have that conversation. Now, perhaps that conversation, someone says, hey, you'd be great for this job. Or I know a friend who, you know, is looking for a new massage therapist, or, you know, and we think, oh, I've manifested this, but I'm, and maybe we have, but how would I would explain it? By going into these unknown moments, stepping in this emotional state of, I'm grateful for what's to come, even though I don't know what it is. We just walk in an emotional state that leaves us open to things seemingly coming from nowhere.
That's so beautifully put. I think it's kind of why I'm here. I think that, you know, the way that I talk and try and show myself and be around people, so many great opportunities have, since I've really shifted into that state post kind of my surf career and post sort of, I'd sort of call like phase one Cooper. It seems like so many more great opportunities are coming to me.
Yeah. I think, you know, as we're talking about this gratitude and people thinking, you know, more good things are coming to me, you know, we're a lot of people have heard and they do a lot of work in this space of, you know, and I'm grateful and I've got vision boards or I know what I want and I'm putting it out there and I'm putting it out to the universe. But we're doing it in a way that actually has an energy of lack to it. So it sort of has this, I hope it comes, like, I hope it gets, oh, I'm really grateful for this and I'm doing that because I really hope this comes. And we're going through our life thinking we're doing this gratitude practice by writing things off and now I sit and hope, you know, Cooper's audience said more good things come. But we're actually really just sitting in fear that it's not all working out for us.
And that's doing it with expectation. And that's where, like, what my dad always said to me as a kid, like, appreciation, not expectation. Yep. Gratitude isn't doing something, expecting something in return. It's just doing something because you're grateful, like, you know, you're just appreciative of it. You're just happy that it's happened, rather than doing something with the expectation that, okay, I'm going to get something in return. Like, that's coming from a place, it's like almost like trying to shortcut it and cheat it. It's like the universe knows that. No, you're doing it for, it's like doing something kind and hoping something for something good in return. It's not really doing something kind then.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it is sitting in that lack of, like, if I do this, then I get that. So I better do that in case I don't get this.
Yeah.
And so we're really, that is an emotional state of fear and striving and hoping. And, you know, I work with a lot of athletes and they quite often go into competition, what I call hoping, wishing, praying. And it doesn't sound like they're being negative, or it doesn't sound like, you know, they're not in a helpful emotional state. But really, like, I hope I play well, you know, I need to play well. I hope the coach puts me in this position. You know, I really want to play that position today. Really, that's just fear in a different disguise. You know, I think what we're talking about with gratitude is it's just what I feel, what I think, how I hold myself, my posture, how I talk, you know, how I look at opportunities. It's coming from a place of, you know, this is good. I have what I need. I've got plenty and I don't know, and more is coming. I don't know how, I don't know what, but
I'm love
here
that.
For it.
I love that you mentioned the athlete thing, because it's something that I used to look at through the wrong lens. We're going way off topic where I normally start a conversation.
Oh,
no, this is my fault. I'm
renowned
for
that.
No, this is great. Because we started at gratitude, I want to go into it. But I just want to quickly mention this, because this reminds me a lot of that, and you'll probably be able to comment on this as a mindfulness coach. And I just remember this so clearly. I did some I had Tom Carroll on the podcast, and you would have heard of Tom Carroll.
Yeah.
Big on meditation, wild story, incredible book if you want to read his story. He he was helping me with a little bit of coaching kind of around surfing and just a bit of direction at one stage. And I kind of, it was when I just started the Good Human Factory and I had this like, I'm doing all this good in the world. Surely it's going to, my luck's going to turn around. And he was like, no one gives a shit, mate. Like people are stoked with what you're doing, but it's not going to improve your chance of winning a surf comp. And I was like, it was a hard truth I needed at the time, but at the time I couldn't really take it on. But now I'm a bit more mature and realize I was doing it with that expectation rather than just doing it because I want to do it.
Yeah. You know, I go through tantrums sometimes. It's like, I'm a good person. I'm helping all these people. Like, when's it my turn? And then it's like, oh, you know, it just unfortunately does not work.
It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't work like that. But, you know, we're human and we get frustrated and resentful and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it's we're going to catch back up to all this stuff because people are going to hear your story and be blown away. And I do normally do my podcast in a way that is a little different to most podcasts. And I know a bit of your story. I mean, your story is quite public around your son, Will, which we'll catch up to. But I haven't heard too much about. You always touch, like, I used to be a good netballer, but then move into the next part. Tell me about up until you finished netball. Tell me about your netball career in high school. What was your upbringing like that I need to know about you to understand how you ended up where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, if you have an average athletic career, it's not really a great selling point for the athletes I work for. So I don't use it as a, like, you should listen to me because I was an athlete. I actually say, you should listen to me because I failed as an athlete.
But
so
that's what I mean. You're human.
You know, I really got a lot of lessons from that. You know, I grew up in, you know, a family. I grew up down on the Mornington Peninsula in Melbourne and just your normal, regular family. But I just loved sport and, you know, was pretty good at it. I did come from an era where, you know, we did not produce these super kids who by the age of 14 were like nearly Olympic athletes. So we played any sort of sport, but netball was my thing. And I often reflect on my mum. We lived a good hour away from the city, so over an hour and 15. And she gave me the opportunity. I was asked, would I leave the local little netball club and go and trial for a club in the city? It was better standard. So my mum would work all day. There was three kids in the family and she would drive me an hour and 15 minutes to and from netball and have to sit there, you know, like 7 days a week. And I honestly don't remember her ever complaining, you know, which is different to the experience my children had growing up. But there was always an agreement between me and my parents. The day that I said I didn't want to go to training was the day that it was like, well, we're out. But whilst ever I wanted to go, they would take me. And, you know, I just played and I remembered I tried out for a state team once and, you know, I clearly wasn't going to get in the team. You can tell at those trials, you know, who they're putting on the court, who they're not putting on the court. I was sitting there. I didn't know anyone. It was like an under 17 state team or 19 state team. I can't remember. I was 16 at the time, 15, 16, and I was thinking, oh, well. And the trials were about to end and a girl got sunstroke. And so one of the selectors had a bib in her hand and I was sort of sitting in the corner. I'd hardly played all day. They're like, yeah, go on. And they must have sort of actually gone, oh, we haven't really looked at this girl. And they put me on and put me on and put me on. And I got in that state team. I'd never really done anything great in netball. All of a sudden I find myself as a bottom age kid in an under-19s team. I go and play. I make the under-19 Australian team. In the same year I make the under-21 state team and then make the under-21 Australian team all in 1 year sort of thing. And I didn't really have any mental skills, no goals, no. It's like one day I just made a team and then the next minute I'm, you know, at the Australian Institute of Sport on scholarship and I really didn't set out to do it and I loved it, but I had no foundation and of values around who I was as an athlete, or understanding of what the sport meant to me, why I was doing it. I just literally was following whatever team I got into. And then as soon as injuries came, I grew up in a family that really valued education, working for the man, you know. And so as soon as it got a little bit tough with injuries, my parents were like, do you really want to do this? There's no Olympics. There's no money.
Mm.
Really? And I just walked away, really.
Huh. Interesting.
And I just thought, oh, well, you should just get a university degree. And so I clearly had some talent, or I wouldn't have made those teams as a junior player. And then as quick as I was there, I was out of the system because I just chose not to.
Do you look back and look at
I look back on
Emma Murray,
like
19 before she got injured, and wish she had someone like you now to help her understand and maybe chase it? Or
I don't know if,
because I feel like a lot of young athletes don't really have that, unless you're at the very pinnacle and you've got the funding around you in a sport. Like I was, like I won an Australian title in surfing at 14. I was in, like, representing the country, and like only four surfers in the 16s and 18s got to go. So I kind of had a little bit of that stuff around, but not many young people really know how much they like want it or love it or have those values around it. Like I didn't learn that till like my early 20s anyway.
And I'd sort of left before I learned it. Yeah, I just sort of, at the first sign of it getting a bit tough and a bit uncomfortable, and a family that valued other things, who would support me. Like I had decided to keep going, they would support me, but they weren't saying, you've got this great opportunity, go and do. Yeah,
give it everything.
Yeah, you know, and it really affected me, like really stayed with me for a very long time, because as you would know, is once you finish, it's gone.
Mm.
Like, not really going back. That's it. You don't go back to high level sport.
Yeah.
And it's like, what was I thinking? I literally wasn't thinking.
Because that's the thing, at like 20, you're like, damn, you can't go back. You only get that one shot in that age.
And I remember at the Australian Institute of Sport, we were told about, you know, they're sports psychologists.
Mm.
You can use them. They didn't explain what they did, why they were there. And I thought, well, I'm not mental. I don't have a mental illness. Like, I've got a good education. I'm from a good family. I don't have anxiety. Like, why would I do that? And I had a stigma about it without even realizing. Mm. And so I just gave, like, a whole portion of my life to netball and loved it. And then just let it go because I had no one to have a conversation with.
Yeah, wow.
And I moved eventually into sort of coaching on the side. I went into university. I went and lived on a university campus.
What did you study when you first went to university?
I was studying an undergrad in psych and communications, and I had started studying that whilst I was still trying to keep my foot in the door at netball. And I just look back now, I'm like, it was ridiculous. I was trying to play high level netball, trying to study, trying to go to the pub with everyone. I had no rituals, habits, no looking after myself. I would be lucky to eat, you know, a chocolate bar on the way to netball training because I'd missed uni campus dinner. I gave myself no chance to do it, but there certainly wasn't anyone in the sport or the university or within my friends who were like, this is probably not a healthy way to go about things. Mm. And what I have learned later in my life after Will's injury is I'm really good at compartmentalizing and just putting things in boxes, not dealing with it, disassociating from it. And I think I did that with my netball. Oh, well, that's a bit hard.
Yeah.
I'm injured. I don't really know what I want or whether I'm even good enough, or I missed out on getting selected for a team. That's an uncomfortable feeling because I just made all these teams in a row and had zero skills whatsoever. I'd never heard anything around mindset or mental health at school. Never anything. Yeah. and just was completely toolless. Like I had no tools in my tool belt to work it out.
Yeah,
so I just walked away.
Let's talk about your 20s then.
So in my 20s, I'm studying. I move into, you know, that's another story of just ridiculous walking away. You know, I do this degree and I have one subject left and I'm like, I'm so done with this. And I
gave it up.
Gave it up. It's like, who does that? But I just had no thought about anything. I would just, this is stupid. I don't like this. And before I know it, I'm in this full-on PR job. I was actually working at the Australian Open in public relations. And, you know, I had chosen public relations literally because my sister's friend did it. I really didn't even know what PR stood for. So all of a sudden I'm choosing my life direction based off my sister's friend, who she looks like she's got her stuff together and that looks fun. You know, just no thought at all.
I can imagine thinking like, oh, it's like that too. If we don't have those mentors and people in place, like, yeah, it's easier to just like follow and like make decisions without too much thought in it than having to actually do that work and understand who you are and what you really want.
Yeah. So I found myself in corporate life. And like anything I sort of do, I'm good at it. I'm fine. You know, I'm doing a good job and opportunities are opening up because I do a good job. I have zero understanding or intrinsic motivation as why I'm there. What's the pathway? What am I trying to achieve? What's my purpose here? I just am there because I'm fairly good at it. And that's that. And then I really start getting uncomfortable. If I look at the pattern throughout my life, once I get uncomfortable and discomfort, rather than having any tools or skills to lean into that, navigate that, question that, it's like time for a change.
You leave and go somewhere
I leave and go somewhere else. And I'm in this career in PR that takes me to a few different jobs, and I start coaching netball just to do something, to reconnect with the sport, I guess. And as I reconnect with netball, I always encourage people to look, when young people are like, I don't know what I'm passionate about. Like, I don't know what my purpose is. I'm like, you don't need to know that, but think about what excites you. What things are you always talking about? What things are you reading about? What podcasts are you drawn to? And for me, I was always secretly, no one really knew, really fascinated by Oprah Winfrey. And like, I was watching Oprah Winfrey at like 16 years old. Wow. I just was really drawn to that and really drawn to, I don't even know how to explain it, because it wasn't mental health. It was this concept that
communication and connection.
Yeah, connection and things, and there being stuff bigger than us. So I'm completely directionless in my life. But if I had 2 seconds to have a conversation with someone about what all this means, I would probably lean into it. So I was all a bit confused about what really, even why I was here and what I liked. I'm doing this PR, I absolutely don't like it. And secretly off wishing, you know, I could watch Oprah Winfrey more. And because we didn't have podcasts and all of the great information that's available today. And I had a coach who was like a coaching mentor, and I coached with her. She was my first state coach. And I was at her house one day, and there was on her bookshelf, I picked up a book called Sacred Hoops by Phil Jackson. And Phil Jackson was the coach of the Chicago Bulls. And he was talking in this book about meditation and mindfulness. And that was not, no one would have heard of that in Australia then. You know, I'm in my early 20s. That was not something that, or mid-20s. It was not something that you would hear. And I think by this stage, sort of I had a young baby, you know, I've sort of skipped over that, to get married, had a kid, and coaching on the side to just still feel purposeful. And I read this book, and this book is Phil Jackson's belief system was that he had these incredible athletes, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, you know, these guys. If he as a coach could help them become really still and present in the moment, that anything that they produce in that moment is going to be better than what he can coach them. So he spent more time in meditation and doing things like blindfolding them, and they were training in the dark, so they had to tune into what they were hearing and what they were feeling. And it just captivated me. And when I was reading that, I think I was pregnant with another child. You know, I've got four of them, so I've lost track which child. But my mum had high blood pressure, and the doctor said, you know, you really need to do something about that. So I said, let's go, mum, let's go and study mindfulness. But you couldn't, I mean, you could go so many places now and find a mindfulness course. You could not find that anywhere. So I did a bit of research, and I found a woman, she was like 80 years old, who would teach it out of her house once a week of a night time for like 8 weeks. And we would go off to this lady's house, and she would teach us mindfulness and meditation. And most people, as I say that now, they've heard of it, they've tried it, you know, they've had someone come to school. This was like nowhere. No one knew anything about it. And I would take these skills after learning it from this lady, and I was coaching, and I would start sharing it with the athletes, and I would start connecting with the athletes more around that than I was around the physical side of the game. And was really fascinated how what I was learning in the lounge room floor of this 80-year-old woman's house, how it helped the goal shooter at netball, you know, be a little bit calmer when she was shooting the ball. So I was already completely drawn to that, even though I didn't really have any reference point that that existed, you know, out there. I mean, do I keep going?
Yeah, keep going. I'm fascinated.
My story.
Yeah,
and,
keep going through, because you notice it. You've got a few young kids.
I've got a few kids.
And then you find mindfulness and realize, hey, wait, this is actually helping my athletes. I'm also fascinated in it. And like you said, it's not something that many people know about in Australia.
Yeah. No. So I didn't have anyone to have conversations with about it or really explore the practice. I just had done this course, and that was that. But I, in my own private life, would be practicing it and curious about, you know, I've got these little kids, and curious about the things that I had learnt. And I, you know, had by that stage, I think, three kids, and, you know, money's tight and life's busy, and I decide that I should go back to work. I was doing work as a netball coach, but really that I should go back into the corporate space. And so I had young kids, and I went back into, you know, sales and marketing. And again, oh, you know, you're good at it. You're getting great results. They love you. But deep inside, I'm like, this is, again, directionless. I don't know why I'm here. I'm turning up to get money. It felt, everything I had done had felt so out of alignment with me. And so I'm going off to work, and really just in my own space struggling with that, but not even really having enough understanding to know I was struggling.
Yeah.
Just grinding out life, really. Mm-hmm. And I had a weekend where I went to a friend's farm, and it was like a friend sort of saying, hey, you're exhausted, you've got these little kids, you're working full time, come, I'm going to look after you for the weekend. And they had the kids, and I was sort of lying in bed having a very rare sleep in and reading stuff online. And I saw an article about a woman who had started a business introducing mindfulness to schools, Geelong Grammar. And I was like, oh, wow, this is that thing that I don't really hear much about. And Geelong Grammar are like this first school to introduce this program. That's a school a private school in Melbourne. And it was like in my head, I'm like, it exists. People can actually make a business from this. I didn't even really know that. And I got out a piece of paper that day. So this was like on a Saturday, and I wrote down a list of everything I did not like about my job. I did not like sales targets. I did not like weekly meetings. I did not like
long list.
Electronic diaries. And I was really like very clear about these things. You know, some people say, oh, it annoys me in my job. I'm like, this actually feels really stressful for mm-hmm. me, having an electronic diary, having to be micromanaged. And I just thought, right, I've got to get a job that doesn't have any of these. And I just read about this woman. Well, she wouldn't have a sales target. She wouldn't have weekly meetings. She wouldn't have any of that stuff. And I went that, you know, 2 days later, and I looked up, you know, mindfulness teacher training, and literally I rang them up. It was the Gawler Foundation. They don't exist anymore. They closed over COVID, and they were like the leading, very traditional mindfulness-based stress reduction, and they were connected to Jon Kabat-Zinn, where it originated from. So not just someone running a little 8-week course. It was it was a fed income thing. And I remember ringing them a few days after I'd made this list of what job I don't want. And they said, oh, we've got a cancellation. We've got one spot, but it's this weekend.
Oh, wow.
And I've got little kids and busy world, and you know, one of the kids had something really important on the weekend, and I just sat the family down and said, I'm going. Mm. And I went, and that was that. And I just then literally went out and created what I wanted.
Yeah. So was that like just a weekend course?
No, that was like a week.
A week, yeah.
That was a week.
A week intensive.
And he came out as like a qualified teacher, and then
in mindfulness stress reduction, though,
in a bit more traditional stress reduction, yeah,
looking at mindfulness through a different lens to how you teach it now with high performance,
yeah. And from there, I went and did, and then that I don't know where the next decision came from, but before I knew it, I'd done a very similar thing to. With clinical hypnotherapy, I really sort of thought, you know, how could I get athletes to really shift quickly?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I can't even tell you how I thought clinical hypnotherapy. And before I know it, I'm at an information session. Before I know it, I'm doing clinical hypnotherapy. And then the next thing, I think I met someone there who introduced me to NLP, and then I did NLP. Now, a lot of people, there's a hell of a lot of coaches out there who do NLP, clinical hypnotherapy, mindfulness, who have done all the stuff that I have done. But I was really clear on this niche. I just knew, I think my netball and my lack of direction and lack of ability when it got uncomfortable to shift my mind and that I wasn't feeling mentally unwell, but I was missing all of these tools,
the performance side
of it. And so I knew what I wanted to create for athletes, and I was really clear on that. And I knew a football coach, Andy Collins, who he worked at Williamstown Football Club, and this was a VFL football club. They hadn't won a premiership for 9 years. And he said, well, hey, you could come down and work with a couple of the players. And the bit I'm proud of in my story is I've got, you know, four little kids by then, mm-hmm. all in primary school. Primary school is very consuming with play dates and coffees and canteen and, you know, weekend get-togethers and things like that.
Too, so.
Yeah. And there's a real, as a mum, it's like you want to stay connected to all of that because so much of your life has been taken from you when you have kids that you there's a real fear of missing out as a mum. Yeah. I know my kid might not get to the play date if I'm not at school pickup, and I've got to, you know, be seen. I've got to have people over to my house. There is a lot of that goes on with being a mum. And I just would put those kids to bed and I would get in the car and I would drive over the Westgate Bridge to Williamstown Football Club, literally the coldest place on earth. It's this concrete toilet block sitting on the side of the foreshore, this wind whipping through it. And I would sit there. I wasn't getting paid a cent. I'd worked during the day. Like, I'd gone to a, you know, full-time job,
put the kids
to bed. I'm sometimes studying till 2 a.m. to do these courses, and I would drive to this football club and I would sit there and I wouldn't know what the hell I was doing, and I would feel petrified.
Imposter syndrome, and probably, because you're trying to do something that really hasn't been done.
I didn't have anyone I could ask, and I'm sort of trying to make it up as I go along. And, you know, these players would come, and I had a teacher in NLP that loved football, mm-hmm. and he just knew everything about it. So this footballer would come and he would sit down and I'd get his story, and then I'd, on the drive home, I'd ring David, what do I do this? And then he'd tell me, and I literally just really had to grind out this building this product, because I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know whether it existed.
There was no blueprint to follow, and not even copy, but no one to really look to to draw that much inspiration. Yeah.
So it was learning on steroids, and it was, you know, I'm still working full time, I'm still raising kids, I'm still studying, and mm-hmm. I missed out on, you know, everything.
A lot of sleep.
Sleep, but also, you know, the coffee dates with mums and the social this and the and
sacrifice.
Yeah, but I never felt like that. And I then knew the general manager of Richmond Football Club. Williamstown won a premiership that year, you know, the first premiership in 9 years. It was not due to me at all. Like, I literally didn't know what I was doing, and I just was sitting in a back corner. You know, they'd got their stuff together, but it was nice to be involved. And I went to Richmond Football Club, knew the GM, and when I went and had a coffee with them, the GM and the head of recruitment were like, oh my gosh, we've literally just been to America and we've heard this guy speak called Michael Gervais. And Michael Gervais was
mastery?
Yeah. And he at the time was the high performance mind coach for Seattle Seahawks, and he is now, you know, the guru of this space. But at the time, he hadn't won a Super Bowl, but he was probably just starting to sort of talk about it.
Yeah.
And the Richmond guys had gone and heard him speak. They're like, oh, yeah, oh my gosh, you're saying what this guy is saying. I didn't know this guy existed. Mm. I'm like, oh, really? Am I? That sounds great.
Mm.
And, so they're all pumped. They're all excited. Like, yes, like, we really want this. And I'm thinking, wow, this is just amazing. And then before the season started, they were like,
what year is this? Because you're with
this
Richmond.
This was 2016.
Okay. So this, I mean, isn't super recent. So by then you still weren't like working full time as high performance mindfulness when you started with Richmond.
So on the side I'm working for, I'm doing girls that I'm coaching at netball. And
For people listening, we're going to pause it here. We're going to keep going through the story. But for people listening now, what was the sort of, like, what's high performance mindfulness? What are the sort of things that you're helping these players with? I mean, I've been at your retreat and I'm a massive admirer of your work, so I know all about it. But can you explain to maybe the listeners what you started to uncover was helping these players play better, helping these organizations get better results than they once were?
So for me, I was like trying to take the pieces of the different things I'd studied, and I was trying to take the experiences from my fear as an athlete and the things that I knew I felt as an athlete, and then the things that I was seeing in the athlete, and I was trying to just like put a puzzle together of what worked and what didn't work. And essentially, I was building the ability to help an athlete come present in the moment, which is what mindfulness is. Mm-hmm. The part that didn't resonate with me with mindfulness-based stress reduction is that if I am teaching an AFL player to become present in the moment, which is mindfulness-based stress reduction, I'm just here in this moment.
And try to be empty and just
still. I'm just here. I'm letting myself be whatever I need to be and just be present. And I was like, "What? Okay, but if I just let this athlete be what they'll be, they've got fear running through them, they've got doubt running through them. They're not going to, if I can teach them mindfulness, they're not going to the stories in their head around it, but ultimately they're still not in a very powerful emotional state to, you know, really nail the game.
Yeah.
They're present, but they're not in their at their best. And so I started playing around with this concept of let me help the player get present, but then let me help him step into that moment by now putting his attention on his strengths, what he can do, what he can bring to the table. But the part that really was getting the results was that what stops a lot of athletes from being present in the moment and bringing their best is subconscious patterning that is not helping them. So they perhaps had missed a goal under pressure, and now every time they go to kick a goal, they tighten up and they miss a goal. They had had a really bad injury in a particular part of the game, you know, putting my head over the ball, I'd got a bad concussion. So now, even though they want to get that ball, their subconscious mind is protecting them, holding them back. Mm-hmm. So I was using a combination of my hypnosis, my meditation, my NLP to try and shift the blocks in the subconscious mind, and so that when I was giving the athlete tools to get present and step into the their strengths, there weren't all these blocks stopping them. There weren't fear and doubt that they couldn't see or feel that was operating. Like the iOS, you know, software of a computer, it was like going in and tidying that up. And I was like,
this is working.
Yeah. I would be like sit there going, oh my gosh, like that worked. And sometimes, you know, hypnosis is the most incredibly powerful tool. It's got a bad rap.
Can you like hypnotize people?
Yeah.
I'll have to do it later on the dinner table.
So hypnosis is this incredible tool, but it has a bad rap because people think of it as stage hypnosis. Yeah. And I was sort of doing it in a way, I've never used the word hypnosis. My athletes called it closed eye. Can we just do a closed eye? And they would close their eyes. I was never doing traditional hypnosis. I was using mindfulness and meditation to get them deeper into a state of relaxation and then using the suggestions of hypnosis to shift them. And I was like, literally like, wow, that like really works. A bit later in my career, but just a story to validate how much this works was I work in motorsport.
Yeah.
And I work with an athlete, Scott McLaughlin. And when I started working with Scott, now I'm going off task, but
I'll bring us back.
Scott McLaughlin, when I started working with Scott McLaughlin, I was introduced to him by an AFL player because he had just lost the unlosable supercar championship. He was leading the championship. You accrue points for every race. And he went into the last race. He had to come 11th to win the entire championship. And he just absolutely
crumbled.
And he made every conceivable mistake and he came 12th and lost the championship. And so an AFL player connected us and I'm thinking, I don't know the first thing about motorsport. Like, I don't even like it as a sport. And my husband was like, no, you've got to, like, he loved it. So he's like, you've really got to do this. And anyway, I worked with Scott. He won back-to-back-to-back supercars. He was like got the most poles in history for qualifying. He just killed it. But he was going into the Melbourne Grand Prix. He had the biggest winning streak in history. He was going for like all these records to win again, pole again, everything else. And Scott had terrible starts. And this is this whole subconscious mind thing. Scott's story was when he was 16 in his first race, he stalled on the start line and the entire field ended up his bum. And so from then up the rear of the car, like a massive pile on stack. And so from then his subconscious mind, whenever he was on the start line, was really conservative because they didn't want him to stall. The subconscious mind's effectively like, just whatever you do, don't stall the car. So it would be really heavy on the start and slow on the start. And Scott was winning everything, doing everything great. So it was like, well, let's like go to the other level. Let's sort this start.
Great too.
Right. So we removed the subconscious blocks. But I would do a little mini visualization before he would go out to race. I still do it. He's in America now. We still do it over the phone. Not every race, but still do it for when he's a bit out of flow. And it's not hardcore hypnosis that I'm doing, but it has hypnotic, principles behind this. And so in hypnosis, you have to be very mindful of your words because the subconscious mind is taking those words and acting on those words. And the words that I said to Scott is that when you get into the car, everything will disappear. You will just see what's in front of you. And, you know, you'll see it really clearly and everything else sort of will disappear out of view. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a new thing that I would say to him. This is something that was working. He was nailing his starts. He was like blowing the fields away with his starts. And he would like dial in. It would just be like all he could see was what was in front. And it was as if he could see the lights to go quicker. He could feel the car. He could hear the noise louder. So I would dial up all these sensors. But on this occasion at the Melbourne Grand Prix, he's going for this record. I forget to say that once you get to the start line, so I've just said, and you're in the car and you lose sight of everything else, you only see what's in front of you. So he gets in the car at the garage, he drives out to drive to the start line, and he just has no sight of the car next to him, and he turns the car straight into the car next to him. He writes off his car. And he writes off the car next to him. But because of the way the subconscious mind works, he had no recollection of seeing that car. So he thinks that car has hit him, and where he's just turned his car into it. So they take the cars back to the garage. It's a write-off, you know, game over. Melbourne, your Grand Prix is like done and dusted. And so Scott goes to the garage of the guy who he's run off the track. And goes to fight him. And I just have this deep realization, I did not say when you get to the start line. I've just said when you get in the car, right? Oh my goodness. And eventually had to say to Scott.
Did you tell him a bit later after they fixed the car?
I told him a bit later. I actually think maybe I didn't do that. Now, that's not even hardcore hypnosis. This is like a 4-minute visualization we're doing on the side of the track before the race. But, you know, our minds are so suggestible. Mm. And what I was learning, it was like playing this like reality TV show. I could go and say this thing to a subconscious mind and then I'd see it out on the field in this player. It was like, this is just amazing. Like, this is great. This is everything I wish I'd had when I was an athlete. And so Richmond were like, yes, this is fantastic.
Yeah, let's go back to Richmond.
Yeah.
And how and when was Will's accident in relation to you starting with Richmond?
So actually this was 2016.
Yeah.
And Will's accident was the following year, but I didn't work with Richmond. Okay. Here I am saying I was going to work with Richmond, but what happened was, so I'm thinking, great, oh my God, I'm going to work with Richmond. And Richmond then come back to me and said, actually, we're going with Leading Teams. So Leading Teams was a model that had another football club had used to use a premiership, and they said, we're going to go down that route.
Is that like a leadership sort of style company?
It's like where you sit someone on a chair and you tell them, you know, what they've got to stop doing, start mm-hmm. doing. There's leadership, you know. Yeah. And they'd had great success at other clubs, and it was like, oh, you know, oh well. And then a few games into the season, I get a call from Richmond saying, hey, we've got this one player, Dylan Grimes. He is really not fulfilling his potential. He's really like, he trains really well, but he doesn't play really well. And he's come to the club saying he wants to do some work that's different to leading teams. He doesn't want to see a cycle. Like, does the club know anything? And his career was on the way out. So they're like, would you work with him? I'm like, yes.
That was your big first opportunity, really.
Yeah, and I'm doing, like, I'm seeing clients regularly. Sometimes they were athletes, sometimes they weren't. I was doing it from home.
So you'd built up a bit of a reputation from the other football club that got their premiership to start.
Yeah, but not even really. Like, I still, like...
It's just like a passion really that you studied a lot and you learned and you loved it. Still working your other job?
Yeah, still working my other job.
People don't love this. I've heard a lot of your stuff and, like, I haven't heard this, but you're told this is amazing.
And so it's etched in my mind, my first session with Dil. Like, I reckon I prepared for a week. Wow. Like, I was like, just, right, like, here's my big gig. And Dil had not strung more than a few games together without hamstring injuries. He was really underperforming. He was probably most likely going to get delisted. So I had my session with him. And literally that first game, his GPS just went through the roof, because subconsciously he'd had so many hamstrings. Whenever he was on a strong lead, his body would just go like, no, I'm going to pull you up. Mm-hmm. And Dil was like, my God, like, this is just gold. So Dil started working with me every single day, every single game, sorry. And, you know, I'd do this and he was getting better and better and better. But the team were not. The team were really underperforming. And like anything, you know, Dil would start saying, he said to Sam Lloyd, another player, well, you should really go and see her. And so Sam would come, and then somehow someone said to Dusty, you should go and see her. And I remember getting a text message from Dusty. I'd never met the guy. I'd never, like, you know, I hadn't worked with the group. Mm-hmm. Like, I was just getting these one little players, and I get this message 2 hours before a game with Dusty saying, hey, Sam Lloyd said I should see you. And I was like, right.
Dusty Martin, for anyone listening who's not a big football fan, is the great, like, at that time as well, the highest paid, like, at that stage, at that he was, like, time, the top player in the AFL, right?
Well, at that time, he didn't have, you know, the biggest contract in the AFL, but he was, like,
on his way.
One of the best players in the league. And Dusty is like this enigma that never does media interviews. No one knows him. He is just like this god of football. And here I've got this text saying, Sam Lloyd said I should see you. And it's like, okay. I said, well, how about we meet in the club 2 hours before the game? So the club's right next to the MCG. Come into the club. We'll do a little session. Then you can go over and play at the MCG. And so Dusty comes and, you know, and he sort of says, like, the team were going terribly. Like, the team were really underperforming, and he's a superstar. And he's like, it's really noisy in my mind. That was the only word he sort of used to describe it. And when I get the ball, I just sort of put it on my boot and just get rid of it really quickly. And you've got to go over to the rooms 2 hours before the game. Like, I had 15 minutes with this guy sort of thing. And I'm massive imposter syndrome. I'm like, I don't even really know what I do here. Like, and yeah, it's sort of been good for Dil and this person, but this is Dusty Martin. And so I got him to straight away, you know, close his eyes and go back into his subconscious mind of when he plays his best football and sort of bring up this picture. And he describes this picture to me, and, you know, he's got this strong chest and his shoulders back, and, you know, he's using words like, I'm strong and I'm unstoppable. And so I said, okay, Dusty, what I want you to do is every time, like, you feel a bit noisy, I want you to stop and I want you to really pull your shoulders back, take this deep breath and just tell yourself, I'm really strong and I'm unstoppable. And, you know, I'd done sort of a little bit of subconscious work, and we went over, we watched the game. Richmond got pumped, but I would watch Dusty and I would see him take this big deep breath and pull his shoulders back. And, you know, I could see him doing this. And he got best on ground. And anyway, the game finishes, we lost. And I get this text message like 2 hours after the game going, this shit really works. And so he started seeing me, and he literally got Brownlow votes from that game forward, which is the medal for the best player in the league. And, you know, he went on to do this work every single week religiously. He would turn up to my house. He would, you know, do this work. And the following year, when Richmond won a premiership, he won every conceivable award that there is to, you know, win. So when someone like that adopts it, right at the back end of 2016, they moved out the leadership program and they said, okay, Emma, you can sort of do the whole group sort of thing. But it still wasn't in the, it wasn't in the schedule. It was like, you can have
pop
access
around and have chats with the players when
right?
they need, like.
Yeah. And I remember going into the club still not knowing much. You would never have heard the word vulnerability at an AFL club. That word was like, boys wouldn't have even known what that meant. You would never have heard the word authentic. You'd never have heard any of these. And I remember going to my first leadership meeting and watching this meeting, like, just sort of quite horrified, thinking. And I remember Alex Rance, who we've had out here at the retreat, this big, strong, you know, he's like, has such a presence, does he? And I remember him coming out of this leadership meeting where they had really just barreled this young kid, because that's what you did in sport. And I said to him, like, Alex, you know, and I was so unsure of myself, but I said, you know, like, how do you expect to win the war if you shoot half your men before you go out to war? And I remember him looking at me like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, well, what do you know about that kid? Like, what do you know about who he is? What do you know about where he's come from, his story? And these leaders are looking at me like, are you nuts? Like, what do you mean? Like, that was so foreign in sport then. And so 2017 rolled around, and you know, Will was injured then, and I was now like at the club.
You've had this big opportunity. Wow, this is the best thing ever in my life. My life's changing. And then the hardest thing ever happens in your life.
Yeah. So I'd been told you're going to work at the club, and, you know, I was finally like, I mean, to put it in perspective, for an entire season going 2 days a week, it was like $10,000.
Wow.
And I was just like, yep, okay, I'll do what I need to do. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, yeah, like, I'm finally on this path. And the day before preseason started, Will broke his neck, jumped off a pier and broke his neck. I was just like, I think it's really important for Will that I do this job. And so I went into Richmond and I'm there, but I'm still not in the schedule. I'm still like, hey, yeah, sure, see the players. And Ben Crow actually was a Richmond fan and knew Brendan Gale, and Ben wasn't doing what Ben does now. He was in marketing, you know, but he was a Richmond fan. And he had heard a guy in America doing this sort of stuff, and he went to the club and said, you should get this guy from America. We'd lost four goals. We'd lost four games in 2017 by less than a kick. So Ben Crow's like, hey, you need to get this guy over from America. And as Ben's describing this guy, they're like, that sort of sounds like what that girl does, that we're sort of paying not much money to hang around the club and not really do anything. And Ben was really instrumental in them using me. Like, he's like, well, you've got to actually use her. Like, you've got to actually give her time in the schedule. And they brought me into the schedule, and that was that.
And then they won the
and premiership. And then they won the premiership. And
1 year off and then 2 more years
yeah.
on.
Yeah, and Scott kept winning, and Oscar's another story, but then Oscar Piastri kept winning. I started working with him when he was 16. And Yeah, I think in sport in Australia, if you have had anything to do with an AFL premiership, yeah. doors get open that are not open to other people. So I'm acutely aware that there's a lot of luck in it and you happen to be at the right club at the right time.
It's just a big timing thing.
There's plenty of other people who are as good at this space as me, but they didn't have
And you have to be working with players who are willing to, at the you know, the right players at the right yeah. time. And, but it sounds obviously... I'm not saying it sounds like I'm here at your beautiful retreat and learning from you and yeah. I find so much value in this stuff. And it just is about helping people get out of their own way.
Effectively, that's a great way of saying yeah. it, really.
Well, not get out of their own way, but understand their thought patterns and sort of step away and witness it. I'm aware of time and we've got dinner very soon.
I know. Let's,
no, but I just want to chat about this, yeah. Like this retreat that we're at right now, because your story goes on and you've now worked where after Richmond 20, what's kind of been your run sport wise since then? Because obviously Oscar Piastri, F1, massive, yeah. It's a massive deal. Australia's greatest hope, I guess, of the next to win a world championship yeah, in yeah. F1 and have a strong seat.
Yep. He's an amazing talent, you know, again, right place, right time. You know, you talk about things just happening to happen for you. His mum was the president of the local netball club and he was 16, I think, maybe even younger. And she's like, oh, you know, my son is in F3. He's not very good. He keeps crashing. Would you have a conversation with him? I'm thinking, I don't want to have a conversation with this kid. I don't have time. You know, I've got these kids. And then I thought, but I really would like my daughter to get in a good netball team. So, I'll speak to your son, but I'll speak to him once and then I'll tell him, you know, who to go and see. And I had one conversation with him and I'm like, this kid's going to be a champion. Like, he's just...
Incredible.
Incredible. You can tell him what to do. He'll follow that. He starts winning. But really, for me, after Will's accident, I was invited to speak... at charities, you know, that were raising money for Will. Hey, would you come along and speak? And I didn't even know, I heard you say this to someone at the retreat, I didn't even know people did speaking. Mm. Like, I didn't even know. I've been to plenty of events where there's speakers, but I didn't actually think people go out to do that. And you get booked. And so I was sort of asked to do some speaking and I started doing some at for corporates because of the premiership and because of Will. And then, you know, that's leading to workshops. So all of a sudden, all of this work, both in corporate and in sport. And, you know, I just said to you before, oh, I'm lucky, right place at right time. But I do reflect that.
You worked hard. You're up until 2 a.m. learning all of these different courses.
I'm leaving my kids. I'm sitting in cold football grounds. I'm working for $10,000 a year. I just had the mindset of like, I'm just going to keep showing up. Mm. And I had no idea of what it was. I didn't have a business plan. I didn't know what it was going to look like. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just kept saying yes to opportunities and I just kept putting myself in opportunities and kept learning and critiquing what I was doing. So I would work with an athlete. I would watch their performance and I would question what was going on.
You started to just enjoy it, it sounds like. And I think there's such a beautiful story in yours for – especially any women out there, mothers out there who feel like, oh, I'm like, you know, I haven't got my passion.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Or I'm too old and exactly. It's too late and the kids need me. And
which is a big thing. And this is a beautiful leeway for us to spend 5 or 10 minutes talking about some of the tools that you teach and what we're learning here, which is so important. And that's that, for one, like there's a belief system above everything. And then we go, our thoughts then control our physiology and our feelings, which then control our actions. Most people aren't even aware that that's happening.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain that concept a little to people? Because I'm sure for you, looking back and you know, talking about it just then, you've got all these thoughts as well, but it's learning how to, okay, how can I change? And your concept is change from my B game thoughts to, well, this is unhelpful. How can I at least change it to my A game thoughts? So,
look at you, star of the retreat, listening.
I listened to a lot of your stuff already. Come on, you know I'm a big fan.
You know, we are in the habit as humans that we go about our life, you know, behaving particular ways, taking particular actions, and we're really self-critical around those actions. We look at what we've done, what we haven't done. We criticize ourselves for not doing enough. And why did I do that? And I'm lazy today. I didn't go to the gym. And I want to bring breathing into my life. But I forgot today. So we're just in this state where we have these actions and we look at them and criticize ourselves for not doing enough. And what we don't do is we don't understand that behind every action that we take, behind every behavior, has been a set of thoughts and a set of feelings. And when people talk about mindset, we quite often think it's just to do with our mind. But I like to say our mindset is a set of thoughts and a set of feelings that dictate our actions. You know, public speaking is a really easy one because it makes most people very uncomfortable. And most people go, I'm not very good at public speaking, because they're looking at the action, they're reflecting on the time that they had to make that speech at school, and it was terrible, and I'm no good at it. And so I've got this really strong belief, I'm bad at public speaking. Mm-hmm. And so it's time for them to present at work or to make a speech at a friend's party. And they start from, because they believe that they're terrible at public speaking, they start having thoughts like, this is going to be bad. I'm going to make a mistake. I'm no good at this. I hope I do okay. And then when it's time to speak, they get these feelings, this mad anxiety. But what's also happening is their throat's constricting, their shoulders are getting tight, their eyes are looking down, their posture's getting small, their chest is getting closed with all of these feelings from these thoughts of, I'm going to make a mistake. So then they stand up and they can't project their voice. They don't look at anyone in the crowd. Their frontal lobe is shut down, so they forget their words. And they don't take great action, and that reinforces the belief, I'm no good at public speaking. And so before we know it, a lot of the actions that we're taking in life are coming from these really unhelpful thoughts and feelings that are coming from these beliefs that are really limiting us. Mm. And we just say, well, that's who I am and that's what I do. And then we get introduced to people like you and your work, and we hear about gratitude, and we hear about kindness, and we hear about bringing in these little things in our lives, and we really want to do it. That resonates with us, and we really know that that's what we want to do. And we wake up and we do our gratitude, and we do it on the first day, and we do it on the second day, but the third day we stop, and then we think to ourselves, oh, I'm never good at keeping up at things, and oh, I'm really busy, and I'm too lazy to do that. And we don't realize that we have these thoughts and feelings. Maybe why we didn't do it on day three was because we woke up with a thought of, you know, I'm so busy today, I don't have time to do anything. But we just think it's another thing we tried to do and we failed at, and it's another thing I'm no good at. And we think if we can't be perfect, or what's the point? So now the rest of the week, instead of being grateful and kind, I just say this is, yeah, I throw it out the door, and this is terrible in my life, I'm no good. And rather than understanding that if I want to create change in my life, it's not just about changing my actions, I have to change the thoughts and the feelings that drive these actions. And it's no different to an athlete. If a footballer wants to change his actions on a field of how he, you know, does a ground ball, has a mark, you know, defends his opposition, he's got to look at the thoughts and feelings. So if he's thinking, I haven't had a touch, I'm useless, I'm hopeless, that person's better than me, I'm going to get dropped together tomorrow, then there's a physiology, there's a change in your feelings. I'm getting anxious, my feet are flat, I stop talking, my eyes go down. And then the ball comes into my area, I miss the contest, and then I say, I'm having a shocker, it's a bad game, I'm going to get dropped. And so I want people to understand that they actually can start to control these thoughts and feelings, but they actually have to have awareness around it. That's a bit about mindfulness. When we say a mindfulness practice, it takes practice. Mm. It takes work to every day look at what I'm thinking, look at what I was feeling. And for some people, that starts retrospectively. So a really nice place for people to start is to reflect on their day, and maybe they saw a moment where they had an opportunity to be kind to someone, but they weren't. They did something selfish, or they you know, had a moment where they went and ate a whole lot of junk food and they were trying to be healthy, or they avoided, procrastinated all afternoon. Perhaps get to the end of the day, reflect back to that moment and ask yourself, what was I thinking and feeling before that?
Mm.
What was I thinking and feeling just before I was really aggressive to that person, or cynical to that person, or didn't help that person? What was I thinking before I ate all that junk food? And what you will notice is there's thoughts and feelings that make you, that are very unhelpful. And when I'm really glad you asked me my story, and I have actually never shared that on a podcast, because the repetitive pattern all the way from when I was 16 making my first netball team is, as soon as I got into discomfort, I just had a knee-jerk reaction to leave, remove myself. And what is happening is we're having these unhelpful thoughts and feelings. I had no awareness. I was most likely thinking, I'm not good enough for this. Who am I? I'm from a small little, you know, regional suburb. I don't play in the big teams in Melbourne. Like, I don't belong here. I was at a private school. None of the kids were from private schools. I just knew I was uncomfortable. I don't like this. Oh, so I better leave it. Stop doing it now. And if we start to look at the actions we're taking in our life that are not aligned with our values, not aligned with where we want to head and where we want to go, if we look at what's driving them, there will be unhelpful thoughts and feelings that are making us uncomfortable. And it's this discomfort that is driving our addiction to phones, our addiction to alcohol, our addiction to, you know, going out, because we are in discomfort and we want to feel different. Get on my phone and I don't have to feel that discomfort. And I want people to understand that they can develop the skill that when they're in that discomfort, they can actually stop. They can look at what they're thinking and feeling and actually get into more helpful thoughts and feelings. So we talk about this unhelpful emotional state is my B game, when I'm sitting in all the stuff that's out of my control and that's what's making me uncomfortable. So you're like sitting with your attention on, I've got too much to do, I can't do this, I don't like my job, you know, no one's giving me enough support. Those thoughts, those feelings are making me uncomfortable. My go-to reaction is to pick up my phone and scroll on social media and waste the morning and procrastinate and then beat myself up about that. Or I could notice it's I'm uncomfortable and I go to pick up my phone and I say stop, and I accept that, okay, it's normal to feel like, you know, uncomfortable when I'm not liking my job, but what can I do right here? What do I need to do right here that's actually going to be better in this moment, that I'm going to better execute this moment, and actually choose a thought, choose a feeling that's more in alignment with the strength that you can bring to that moment.
And that you're more in control of as well.
Yeah, and that makes you feel like, you know, okay, I don't love my job and, yeah, I'm uncomfortable and I don't want to do this task, but you know what? If I just stop now and I just really reflect on who I get to help by doing this task and what I'm actually achieving here, okay, well, if I just focus on helping someone, now I'm shifting those thoughts and feelings into something more helpful.
And I'll give you a perfect leeway into the last little part of this podcast, which I want to talk to you about, my 100-kilometer race I've got coming up. So we'll use a real-time example.
Yeah.
I'm on the race, 60 Ks in, and my mind goes to, what are you doing? You're not a runner. Of course your body's going to shit out here.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I feel like we should have a whole podcast on why you even chose to do this in the first place. I think it's just really impressive to
I think my why is to know what I am capable of, but also to hopefully inspire others that they're capable of more than they think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's important for people to know that that doesn't need to look like a 100-kilometer race.
Exactly, it looks like a 20-kilometer one for Carol.
Yeah, or it could look like in that moment that you want to open a bottle of wine and eat a cheese platter instead of going to the gym, that you stop and you challenge yourself rather than going into that old story of, I've had a hard day and I deserve it and I don't like my boss, so I'm going to open wine, that you challenge yourself to do things differently. Yeah. One's a 100-kilometer race. One is actually going to the gym instead of opening the wine. But they're both a challenge, right?
Yeah.
And they both take you to choose your mindset. So you're in this race.
Yeah, so I'm 70 Ks in. I'm like, what am I doing this for?
Yeah.
I'm not a runner.
Are you in pain, do you think? 60
I probably will be in pain.
Yeah.
But I'm in pain, but I also know that I can pass the pain. There's a lot of other people out here running this race with me. I've trained. I'm prepared.
Yeah.
Kind of. But yeah, it gets to that point when I want to quit.
Yeah, so you're thinking, your mind's saying, you don't need to do this.
Yeah, quit. Yeah, you don't need to do this.
Like, just quit. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so firstly, it's, you know, the first step that I teach people is if we don't have acceptance over what's going on for us, then we're going to keep spiraling into that noise. Our mind's going to keep telling us the same story until we look at it and we accept that, hey, yeah, I get what's going on here. So first for you, it's accepting, well, it's normal to have thoughts like that. Of course I'm going to have thoughts like that. Accepting that my thoughts are just thoughts. They're not real. Mm. They're not based on evidence. And also accepting that as humans, we're wired for comfort.
Mm.
And so right in that moment, your mind is just trying any trick possible to get you to stop so that you can get back into a state of comfort.
Mm-hmm.
So your mind is trying to get you to quit because it wants you...
Expect it.
Absolutely expect it. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, expect it, then accept it. David Goggin has a great podcast. I can't remember where he's talking about it, saying that the humans give up at 40% capacity, right? And the reason why they do that is because the human race is wired for survival. Mm-hmm. So not only do you want to stay alive, but you want to stay alive with enough energy in the tank to go home, have sex and procreate effectively. Mm-hmm. So your mind is like, hey, stop, with plenty of stuff in the tank. So one, it's just actually looking at the thoughts, seeing them for what they are. Ah, here it is. I knew it was coming. Yeah, and I accept that that's normal. I accept that that was going to come.
Focus on what I can do. Yeah,
yeah, but here's a tricky thing, right? Yeah. If you just do that mentally, your attention is, if you don't give your attention a job, it's going to go off into those stories. It's like, if you're not going to keep me here in the moment, I'm going to go and find those stories. There's no job for me to be here in the present moment. So I'm going to go up to all these thoughts and try and get you to stop. So when we are doing something like long distance running or we're doing something where we're in pain, we have to understand that we only have one attention, one focus. So once you accept that, yeah, accept those stories are there, they're not real, blah, blah, blah. I want you to grab your attention and I want you to take it to something very small. So remember at the retreat, we were like, big feels, big emotion, small focus.
Yeah.
And this is where you have to think, like, if you are feeling like your feet are sore, you don't want to take your attention down to your feet because you're going to find more pain.
Mm.
And then it's like, see, I told you you should stop. So you want to take your attention where your attention has to get busy. Your attention has a job that it has to do in the present moment because you can't be in two places at once. I can't be with my attention checking in if my little fingers are relaxed and have my attention on, I need to quit.
Yeah.
Or my sore feet. Or I need to quit. I can't be in two places at once. So you have to, in that moment, give your attention a very specific job. And I would have a checklist to go to.
Mm.
And so if your feet are sore, I wouldn't go there, but let's imagine your feet are okay. So first it would go, okay, attention, go down to my feet and feel the difference in my foot strike between my left foot and my right foot. Your attention's got to work to do that. Is there a difference between my left foot and right foot? Is there a difference between the balls of my feet and the heels of my feet? Hey, attention, could you see if you could feel your toes in your shoes? So your attention's really like down there. And then pretty quickly it's going to get sick of that. And so it's like, hey, can you come up to like my hips? Check in. What's happening when I'm doing my, you know, is... How's my hips as my left foot hits the ground versus my right foot?
Mm.
Now I'm going to go up to my posture. A posture is a really good one because you're probably by this stage slumped, hunch down. So it's like, hey, let me go up, check in on my posture. Hey, attention, can you check in on my shoulder blades dropping back into the pockets? Can you go into my hands and try and see if my hands relax? But the best one for you is face. So I work with some Olympic runners, and when the pain hits, like, you know, the last corner of an 800 meter race, I'm like, go into your face, go in. Can I soften my eyes? Can I soften my jaw? Because as we get into these stories of pain and quit, I'm like getting tenser and tenser and tenser. And it's the tension in my face and my shoulders that are sending a message to my mind. This is really bad.
Because like the thoughts create the physiology. If you hack any of them, so it can change all of them.
If you can soften your shoulders, soften your hands, soften your gaze on the trail, go in. Can I soften my jaw? Can I soften my mouth? Can I take the tongue off the roof of my mouth? Now, your attention's really busy with all of that, and you're softening at the same time. And by the end of that, now your body is not sending a message to your mind, hey, this is bad, I'm in danger here, because you're soft, you're relaxed. And so every time you get those thoughts, you have to pick up that attention and give it a job. Now, here's what I say. If you are feeling like you are really, really stuck in your head, then you can give yourself, your attention, a job in the environment. Hey, what can I... What if you know this one? What are five things that I can see? What's something that I haven't seen? What can I hear? What, so taking your mind outwards is really good, is really beneficial. If you are like, oh my God, I've got so far to go, I'm only at the 20K mark and I've got to make it all the way to that top of the hill, and if I don't get to the top of the hill, go inwards, checking on my face, checking on my shoulders. So you can sometimes go external, sometimes go internal. But you are using it to keep yourself
away
from the stories. Once the story's passed, drop into flow. Like, just be in that moment. When the stories come, give your attention a job. Now, this is something you can practice.
It is.
This is not, you don't want to do this for the first time in a race.
Yeah.
So I say to people, you know, just set yourself the first, you know, at, on every hour, I'm going to do it for, or every 15 minutes, I'm going to do it for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Or when I, you know, from this tree to the top of that hill, I'm going to, focus, you know, practice controlling my attention. So you want to train your ability to control your attention and start to see, whenever I go into my tiny little fingertips, I really relax because I have to work really hard to go and find that. One thing I say to athletes is beware. In mindfulness, we say go to your breath. Sometimes if you go to your breath and you're an athlete, it drives those stories. It's like, oh my God, I'm buggered. I can't breathe. And it can bring on anxiety.
Yeah.
So I steer clear of that that breath a little bit. I'm also not an ultra marathon runner. So other runners might say to you, no, the breath is really good. Yeah, you can get into a rhythm with the breath. So they're the sort of things that you want to practice. What does it feel like when I hold my attention on the breath? What holds my attention on the breath? What about when I go to my feet? Oh, when I go to my feet, I realize how sore my feet are. That doesn't feel good. So practice it. Yeah. Work out what you like.
Yeah, I love that. A few of the, like one that David Goggins talks about, he's like, when your mind goes, go to your body.
Yeah.
And then when your body goes, go to your mind. And one of the best things I heard, I got told this by a guest recently, and he got told this by someone who gave him a recommendation, and you might like this, I don't know if you might not have heard of this. He said, when you get past like the longest run you've ever been on, you're going to somewhere you've never been before. So be a tourist in your own mind. Don't, like, you go anywhere, just be observant. Go, oh, wow, this is something I've never seen before. Oh, this is like a, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, instead of judging it, be like a tourist in it. And I was like, huh, I love that.
You know, let me circle all the way back to the 8-year-old who first taught me mindfulness.
5 minutes, I reckon.
Oh, yeah, don't worry about dinner. Let me circle all the way back to the 8-year-old that taught me mindfulness. She told me a story that I did not understand at the time. I was like, that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. And she said that she was a widow, and she said, oh, when my husband died, I thought to myself, I wonder what it's like. I wonder what life's going to look like as a widow. I wonder what it's going to feel like now as a widow. I'm really curious about that. And I was just so new to mindfulness. I'm like, what? Like, you've been married to this guy for 60 years and your reaction in grief is curiosity around what life will look like now as a widow. And I didn't have a full appreciation for mindfulness until I learnt it, you know, very formally. And effectively, it's like when we go through life with curiosity rather than judgment, then there's no struggle in the moment. It's just like, oh, well, I'm, you know, let me just see what's in this moment.
No good or bad.
There's no good or bad or hard or struggle. It's just, oh, in this moment, that feeling's coming up and that thought. So that tourist in a mind is like the widow saying, oh, well, let me see what, let me be a tourist now of what being a widow looks like.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, it is a difficult thing to do.
But it takes practice.
It takes practice. Yeah. But if you have a genuine curiosity around what's coming up for you, absent of that judgment, then so many moments, every moment becomes a learning moment.
Yeah.
Because every moment it's like, oh, look what I do in this pressure. Look what happens in that moment. And so I think that's, whoever gave you that advice is incredible.
Yeah,
I
think curiosity is like the most important trait.
Yeah.
It's like if you're curious, anything's possible. Yeah. If you're closed-minded, nothing's possible, you know, it's in your mind anyway.
But in mindfulness, we call, there's something called meta attention, where it's having attention on your attention. Yeah. So being really like paying attention to where your attention goes in that moment. Yeah. Paying attention to what happens when you put your attention down on that thing.
That's something I love as well with what the work we've been doing here around self-belief. Once you start being curious about your self-beliefs, you're like, huh, I'm not my self-beliefs. I got it from somewhere. I got it from this story that I told myself because a teacher told me at school that you're not good at speaking. Like,
yeah. One, when I started this whole, I guess sort of entering athletes' subconscious minds, and sometimes I think I wish I could write a book about what comes up in their sessions, because I've got this AFL superstar who's on this goal-kicking poor performance streak. You know, he can't kick a goal. And when I go into his mind to go back to where that came from, it came from an article that was written on his draft year when he was in year 12 that said, you know, when he's 45 out, he struggles to kick a goal. And in that moment, the subconscious mind went, you can't kick 45 metres out. And now I'm this AFL legend, played 100 games, and I can't kick the ball then. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
We have so many.
It's crazy where they all come from.
Yeah, and they're driving our behaviours, and then we beat ourselves up and we just think we're weak or we're lazy or we haven't done the work. We're really, let's actually start being curious.
Yeah, I love it. Well, we could talk for hours, and I'm sure we will have another chat down the line. Sorry, Dil, we're going to be having a chat every year as well. But no, I'm so appreciative of this conversation. And thank you so much for going. Like you said, you haven't really shared your story like that on a podcast. I really appreciate you being vulnerable and giving me the opportunity to share that. And hopefully it gave you, it sounded like, a chance to reflect and really see that, oh, wow. But I just think there's so many takeaways, especially for mums out there, to show that, hey, you can find a career that really fulfills you, that if you're willing to continue to learn, to continue to have curiosity and to not settle for, you know, something that you're not happy in.
Yeah, and that you don't need to know what it's going to look like. I didn't know where it was going to take me. You don't need to have it laid out. You don't need to have certainties around it, and that it's okay. If I had never got a job at Richmond, I still would have loved, I never did this thinking I would work at an AFL club. I did it because I loved the study. I found it curious. I found it interesting. I wanted to be with people.
How can you help people using their
mind? Absolutely. But, you know, I guess I want to say to you that my repeating my story out loud like that it really, I hope it reinforces to you the importance of to continue to do what you're doing. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we didn't have podcasts, but there are going to be a young surfer out there, a young netballer out there who's listening to the guests, is listening to your gratitude piece, and is hopefully even getting one or two tool belts that means they don't just go, this is uncomfortable and the only option I have is to just walk away, you know, and that they actually can try something to change those feelings, really. Like, just let me use something that you've said to, in this moment, think differently and feel differently.
And I know there is like the amount of people that have listened to different guests and got little bits. It's like, that's why I'm so passionate about it, because I'm like, we can learn so much if we're curious and can listen to people. But I can hear everyone eating downstairs. I am going to finish the podcast with the same question I finish with everyone.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm excited to hear your answer to this. So what does being a good human mean to Emma Murray?
Yeah, I mean, do your guests know that I should have prepared for this, shouldn't I? But
No. They don't know they're getting a lot are like you. A lot take a minute to answer it. So just whatever. Yeah. And it'll change. You know better than anyone. You'll answer it differently in a month than you do right now. What comes to mind right now? What does being a good human mean to you?
For me, empathy is one of my greatest superpowers. Mm. And it's something that, you know, I have a formal name for now, but for my whole life I have been able to really be empathetic towards other people. I do think empathy and kindness are different things, but they do go hand in hand. And I just think this world is tough. Being human is really tough. And I really think if we just got that piece right, a little bit more right than we get it. Like, if we just, all of us went into our day, even if you can't get the kind bit right, at least have the capacity to get in someone's shoes and say, well, I get it. And the number of moments in my day-to-day life that would be a struggle, but they're not, because I'm like, you know what, I get why that person's doing that.
Mm.
And I have a lot of people in my world who are like, what? How can you say that? They're doing this. And it's like, I get it. Like,
well, you don't get it, but it's okay. I don't need like, to get it. Like, I can't judge because I don't know what they're going through.
Yeah. So at or least I can empathize. When I say I get it, I'm just saying that I don't know their story. I don't know what's going on for them, but I get that you could struggle in this moment. I get that you're not always going to show up your best. I get that we sometimes say things that we shouldn't say. I get that. And I just think if you are not connecting to empathy because it means you've got to let that person off the hook, or connect with empathy because it's just less struggle human. For you.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, makes your human journey a lot, absolutely, a lot better. So
I got told once, this is the last thing I'll say, is if you lived every day in that person's shoes and through their mind, you'd act exactly the same as they are. So you can't judge 100%.
Anyone. And I just fundamentally think, and it's one of the first things I say to any sports coach that I'm working with, if we could just all agree that humans are trying their best.
Mm.
And, you know, you might say, how can you say that? That person robbed, you know, that store. It's like, yeah, because they're trying their best.
Mm.
They're trying their best to feed themselves, or they're actually trying their best to fulfill their addiction.
Or,
you know, like, they're trying their best. So if we fundamentally meet people with the stance of we're all trying our best, then maybe we'd be a little bit less judgmental and a lot more empathetic around
absolutely. Well, we're going to wrap it here because we'll keep talking. But thank you so much for having me at your incredible retreat. I've learned so much and I'm going to continue to learn from you. I'm very excited to continue our friendship. And thank you so much for jumping on Good Humans Podcast.
Thank you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.